The Month in Review, what Maine news mattered to you in January? We are about to put the coldest month of the year in Maine into the rearview mirror. This month, we saw frigid temperatures and chilly politics, both in Maine and Washington. In Augusta, issues included Medicaid expansion, regulations for marijuana sales, Narcan, and wind power. In Washington, of course, there was the State of the Union address last night and our delegation's response to it. The town of Jackman is getting back to normal after firing its town manager, whose offensive social media posts shocked the state. And immigration enforcement is affecting Maine cities, families, and buses. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we'll discuss these issues and more with three Maine editorial page editors. Which stories affected you? What will have the biggest impact on our state? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. It seems like it was years, not just weeks ago, that the winter storm and power outages were making Maine headlines. January has been full of headline-making news, from the growing list of gubernatorial candidates to issues before the legislature, which is back in session. Today, our panel of editorial page editors returns to discuss the news that made their papers front page and back page this month. In the studio with me, Ben Bragdon. He is editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. Greg Kesich, editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. And joining us from our Bangor studio, Susan Young, editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News. As always, we want to hear from you. Which stories this month mattered most to you? What do you think is an angle that maybe isn't being talked about enough? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. It's hard to sort of categorize the biggest story of the year, but I'm going to say it's what happened in Jackman. And Greg, what do you think? Do you think that this is just going to, we're going to look back in a few years and say, hey, remember in 2018 when this guy got hired and posted this stuff? Or is this sort of the tip of something else?
That's a really good question. He is clearly a weirdo, kind of a solitary in some ways figure. But he is tapped into a national movement of far-right extremist. They don't want to call themselves Nazi sympathizers, but they say a lot of sympathetic things about Nazis. And, the guy is coming in with a lot of the visual signs of a racist. He wears his bald head and the trench coat buttoned up all the way, and he talks about concepts like the 95% solution, which hints to the final solution that Hitler talked about, and he plays with phrases like folk and folkism, which really echoes back to a lot of minds to Hitler talking about the Volk in Germany, and then if you say he's a racist, he gets very offended and backs off. And there's a whole sort of online culture in the far right where mostly guys play with these concepts and tiptoe towards them. And then when they get called on it, it's either a joke that you can't take or I can't believe you would say that. That's nothing about what I'm about. So this guy's part of that undercurrent. And the real question, I think, for us is how big is this undercurrent in Maine?
Yeah, and do we know? Do you have any sense, Susan? Yeah, go ahead.
No, I think that's exactly the question. How many people think along the same lines as he did? I mean, we see it on Facebook, Twitter. We get some letters to the editor and things like that from folks expressing similar ideas. And it's so interesting that, as Greg said, as soon as you bring up the fact that they're racist or against certain ethnicities, no, as he said, I love all races, but I really love white people.
they've learned to really pretty up the rhetoric for the wider audience, and it's all these stuff that well, if you're going to talk about equal rights for African Americans, and I'm going to talk about equal rights for whites, what's wrong with that? And that's just enough apart from straight up Nazi rhetoric that it can find a different audience.
Here's the thing. He's not from Maine,
but
for some reason he was attracted to Maine, or others being attracted to Maine. Do we have any evidence?
Apparently, that comes up every once in a while on some of these message boards. Like Greg said, there's this whole subculture that's built up, and they've been able to connect online. And I guess that comes up sometimes. Like, Maine's a good place for us to look. It's white people, which really should concern us that we're kind of seen that way. But it's really hard to dig down and to tell where this how many people hold these views. But it's certainly a lot more than I think most people would want to realize.
Sure, and there's another layer of the story here. You got to feel for the selectmen. Maine is full of small towns where either volunteer or elected regular people are making decisions about who to hire. And, in this case, they hired someone they were uncomfortable with for one set of reasons. But we also have the whole sexual assault and harassment, thing coming to light throughout the nation. And apparently a shortage of people who are qualified for these offices to be town managers.
Yeah, no, that's interesting.
I think an enterprising individual could make a lot of money right now going around to these towns and teaching these folks how to do Google searches. And I think that's what every journalist did as soon as they heard about this guy. We were all on Google and digging up all kinds of information. So on some level, it's pretty shocking. They said they did a thorough search, but didn't seem to be too thorough if they couldn't turn up anything. I mean, these weren't suddenly new views that he had since he landed in Jackman. Mm-hmm. There was lots of documentation. So I think town officials are going to have to learn how to be a little bit more web savvy.
But I would say in their defense, Susan, the worst stuff was on a website I'd never heard of called Gab. And it's like a white supremacist Facebook. And who got into those comments was Andy O'Brien and Crash Berry,
right.
who deserve some credit for breaking this open.
They just
started investigating it, and they came up with it. And I can understand how the selectmen would have missed it, because I would have missed it.
Okay, moving on. State of the Union happened last night. Our congressional delegation sent out news releases afterwards and made the rounds this morning. I know they were on Morning Edition with Irwin. I'm sure they've been speaking with you all as well. What have we learned about our congressional delegation's reaction to the State of the Union? Any surprises? Ben, you go first.
I don't know. If I were them, I would be wondering exactly how to take this. It was a little short on policy details last night, and kind of long on stories that kind of pointed in a certain direction. But he did talk about an immigration compromise, giving up a little bit to the wall and to enforcement and lowering the level of immigration in order to come up with a deal for the Dreamers. If you're amenable to that deal, what do you think? I mean, how do you know whether a president like Donald Trump is going to be able to follow through on that? It's not clear that even he wants to. And if he did want to, that's not going to be, he kind of runs into people in the House that are just better at politics than him. So it's kind of hard to come out of, I think, the State of the Union last night and wondering what direction is going to happen in the next few weeks.
Like every State of the Union address, I mean, people heard what they wanted to hear. And there, he hit a lot of the Republican talking points, as Ben mentioned, immigration, took credit for the biggest tax cuts in history, which isn't quite true. Mm-hmm. The booming economy, which was certainly on the upswing before he was elected. But with Trump, he gave a good speech. He read it really well. But as we know, his personality, how he makes decisions, what he will focus on will be totally different than what we heard last night. So that's really what matters. You know, what priorities does he tweet about? What priorities is he pushing for Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan? And is he going to back the wall? Is that his biggest priority? You know, is it going to be infrastructure funding, spending? Where's that money going to come from? So, you know, a lot of interesting things, but that doesn't mean that any of these things are going to happen or that he'll even continue to focus on them.
I thought his infrastructure idea sounded like a Trump hotel. You know, he said, we're going to leverage $1.5 trillion in spending, which means we're going to borrow.
And it was going to be gleaming.
Yes. The beautiful roads. I mean, we're going to borrow a little bit. And then he said, we'll have partners in state and local government. Well, you know, that's not going to help Maine if we're already having trouble paying for our roads and infrastructure. The expectation is that we're going to have more money to spend on this kind of projects. And then what he said during the campaign, and he mentioned it again last night, is getting a private sector. And private sector will do some things, like they'll build the Maine Turnpike, but they're not going to build a highway, you know, from Bangor to Calais. You know, it's just not going to happen.
And we should note that yesterday on Maine Calling, Governor LePage supported Trump's idea of not having much federal money and trying to look for private investment.
Just get rid of all the environmental controls.
We're talking about the month in review. We'd love to hear from you. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page what is important to you and why. Let's talk about immigration. It seems as though in Maine we have sort of three different things going on. First, there was a letter that was the Department of Justice sent to Maine cities and towns telling them to stop being sanctuary cities. I'm not using the right language, I'm sure. And then we have buses being stopped, Concord coach buses. No one arrested, but ACLU saying that this is happening more frequently than it did before. And then, of course, the case in Waterville where the man, I believe his name is Lexius Saint, I'm drawing a blank
Martin.
On the Martin, that's right, has Saint been seized. He has a wife and family in Maine, a cleaning business, 10 years ago had a drug conviction and is, it seems, going to be deported to Haiti. Depending what the courts decide, all these things happening, at the same time, are we expecting more of this?
Yeah, I think so. The last two are certainly connected. Border Patrol has jurisdiction up to 100 miles inland from the border or from the coast, and that covers all of Maine. It covers many states, but you can understand why that might be necessary. You know, you can't just stay within 10 feet of the border and hope to catch everything coming through. That gives them a little leeway. In the past, they've already always been, these types of stops have been less frequent and usually more targeted. It seems like there's a ramp up in what a lot of people would consider random stops or stops just looking for illegal immigrants with no real purpose. Where the last few years of the Obama administration, it was kind of the policy to only go after the worst of the worst, and that everybody else was, even if they had a deportation order over them, like Mr. St. Martin did, to kind of keep that there as a reason for that person to stay connected to the community and not step out of line again, and as a tool to get them out of the country if they do step out of line again. Now you're seeing these people are being just picked up off the street in Maine, everywhere, and kind of brought into the ICE umbrella, and that's a real change, and that's a central part of the Trump administration. So we can only expect to see more of it.
I guess one thing I would throw in you asked if there would be more, and I think we are seeing some more today. There was a letter went out last night to from House member Larry Lockman, who was an opponent of immigration, not only of illegal immigration, but legal immigration. And he was trying to drum up opposition to a bill that would create these centers for welcoming new immigrants to Maine in terms of helping them with English classes, job placement, that kind of thing. And he had cast it in very stark racist terms about how this is they want to replace us. They want to replace white people with dark people. He didn't say dark people. I guess I shouldn't put words in his mouth, but he referred to what was the line?
The war on whites.
Yeah, the war on whites.
Which is one of these white supremacist dog whistles.
Yeah, white genocide is another one, you know. And so that's the kind of thing that's the way these speeches translate into policy and into real people's lives.
Yeah, and
but although immigration is clearly a priority of the Trump administration, let's remember what he said before he was elected, and he kind of hinted at it again last night, that their focus is going after the drug dealers, the rapists, the bad hombres, as he called them. And, you know, the case in Detroit where you see the man who's lived in the U.S. for 30 years being deported to Mexico, and Mr. St. Martin here in Waterville, these are not the bad hombres. Mm. This is going after people who are just going about their lives. You know, Mr. St. Martin did commit a crime, but he served his time and, for all what we've heard, has been a productive citizen supporting his family, doing what we want people to do. And now we're kicking these kinds of people out of America. I think it really raises questions about what kind of country we are becoming and whether people are okay with that.
Yeah, and think what this means for people of color in Maine who already stand out a lot, and what it means to have border agents and immigration combing the state, looking for them, and also, you know, these deputized local police forces who when they see a person of color driving a car, are going to automatically assume that maybe they're here illegally, and they're going to go after them in that way. It's you already stand out a lot as a person of color in Maine, and you got to feel like you have a target on your back now.
It seems as though things we've read about happening in other parts of the country for all these years are coming here now. We do have to take a quick break. I still want to talk about a whole lot of topics, including the field of gubernatorial candidates. When we come back, your comments and questions as well. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does the Maine Early Learning Investment Group, committed to supporting quality early childhood education by partnering with Dead River Company, MELIG.org, and Deegan Wealth Advisors, an independently owned wealth management firm providing investment advice to individuals, families, and institutions. Information at DEIGHAN.com.
So what exactly happens when you become a supporter of Maine Public Radio? Simply put, you make it happen. You help bring NPR and the BBC here to Maine. You enable Maine Public News reporters to do their thing in Augusta and throughout the state so that we're aware of what's happening and why here in Maine. You help Maine Calling have those important and interesting daily conversations with Maine voices. You help Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Classical to each better focus on trusted news programming or great music and acquire the best programming in the public radio system for our state. You help spread the signal online and over the air to virtually the entire state, reaching every citizen for free. In short, you make public radio happen. So thanks for doing your part right now or on Super Thursday, February 8th, mainpublic.org or 1-800-866-1475. Thank you.
It's a glamorous combination of show business and big business with a game of American football somewhere in the mix. This week's Super Bowl is the sport's chance to show itself off to the rest of the world. I'm Bill Littlefield, and I'll be exploring the culture and history of this sport and asking whether it helps explain why ex-players are suffering from brain injuries and, in some cases, taking their lives.
Join us for the BBC special. That's tomorrow afternoon at 2 on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the month of Maine News in Review. With me in the studio, Greg Kesich, editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram, Ben Bragdon, the editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel, and joining us from our Bangor studio, Susan Young, editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News. I invite you to join the conversation. Call us 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Before we go to those calls and emails, though, we do have to talk about the gubernatorial race. I think we're down to 24 candidates.
Right. I'd like to announce I'm not running.
What about you, Ben? Yeah, Susan?
I'm still in the
exploratory phase.
I have an exploratory phase, committee.
Okay. I'll give an announcement next week.
Who wants to make their best prediction about what the primary will look like?
Well,
Susan, what do you think?
Don't everyone jump at once.
Will we be voting using ranked choice voting? And if so, how does that work?
Oh, boy, it's become a two-part question.
Yeah. And math. It's
more complicated.
If you pause longer, I'll add questions.
Yeah. Just off the top of my head, I'm going to say no to ranked choice voting. And... oh, geez. It's hard to predict who's going to come out ahead. I think you have to take a serious look at Sean Moody. And he's got the powerful team behind him with the LePage folks. You know, Brent Littlefield's been very successful in getting people elected. So, I don't think you want to discount him at all. Also, total toss-up on the Democratic side. I'm just going to say Janet Mills to say something.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we got some indication that may or may not mean something with finance reports.
Yeah. I mean, some people, Janet Mills and see Adam Cody
yep.
and Sean Moody certainly did well. I think Ken Fredette didn't do as well as he thought he was going to do, maybe. But, you try to read the tea leaves with these things. But Sean Moody's pretty new. I mean, I know he ran before, but he's you just never know how these things are going to play out. And, I thought it was interesting yesterday on the show, you had the governor and you asked him if his followers were going to coalesce behind somebody. He was very certain about it. I don't know if he meant that Republicans will eventually all get behind somebody or whether he meant, whoever he kind of tips his hat to will be the one that kind of separates from the pack. And that'll be kind of interesting to see what role he plays in the primary.
I liked what he said. You asked him if he would endorse somebody and he said, no, but I'll unendorse all of the Democrats and Mike Thibodeau, which I thought that was really interesting.
Greg, you in an email to me said that you think there are more candidates than political reporters in Maine. I love that
I
line.
So.
How does one stand out? Especially, I don't think people are really focused on the primaries if we're not journalists right now.
Right. It's interesting, right? Because there is going to be a glut of people trying to get attention all at the same time. I really feel bad for people who are running in primaries for legislature because they're going to get no attention. In primaries, it's always a question of who turns out to vote. And that's it's somewhat unpredictable. It usually is. I mean, you usually know the party stalwarts are the ones who actually bother to turn out in June. And if you're appealing to them, chances are you'll get the nomination. But in 2010, LePage surprised everybody by generating a much higher turnout and leapfrogging all the people who had been ahead in the polls, which were based on modeling of previous Republican primaries, and won that race going away. And he was outspent. And so he found a way to connect with the people he needed to connect with. There was a lot of talk when Susan Collins was thinking about running, how she would be able to tap into independents who normally vote for her in general elections but don't vote in primaries. and could that you she get them to turn out and vote?
Get them to register as Republicans.
Republicans
in the vote,
for
yeah.
the day, you know, yeah. And you know, Adam Cody is in a similar situation where he has a lot of crossover appeal. He would be a good general election candidate, but he's not part of the Democratic establishment, and he doesn't have the long ties to a lot of the constituent groups that, say, Janet Mills or Mark Eaves has. Does he have some way to reach those voters that goes beyond, you know, the usual methods?
Interesting. We're going to go to Nate, who's calling from Owl's Head. Hi, Nate. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. You began the hour talking about the town manager in Jackman, and you were asking the question, how isolated an incident is this? And I just wanted to point out that it was only a few months ago that the Roy Moore story was, you know, the front page headline across the country. And many of Roy Moore's most controversial comments were taken from his interview with a radio show, that which I won't name and give free advertising to. But that was out of northern Maine. And a couple years ago, across central Maine, we had a rash of propaganda distribution by the Ku Klux Klan. So although these stories are all separate and maybe seemingly unrelated, I think you have to look at it as part of a current, maybe a quiet, maybe a small current, but definitely a current that runs through the population. And it's something that we should not close our eyes to or be unaware of.
Nate, yeah, thanks for your call.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a really good point. I think we should keep in mind we have a governor who said, you know, Hispanics and Black people are our enemy. So, you know, I don't know how much of a role that plays, but, you know, we've got our chief executive displaying, you know, tendencies like the town manager in Jackman favoring white people and denigrating people from of other races and from other countries.
Yeah, this is an overstated point, maybe, and maybe it's just the people I listen to, but you know, we are people in this country are so concerned about Islamic terrorism. And not concerned at all about white nationalism. And at some point, we're going to have to reckon with why that is.
We have a tweet.
Department of Homeland Security put out a report yeah. saying that white nationalism was a major threat under the Obama administration. And, you know, they quietly kind of walked that back because of the criticism they got. But, you know, these are the folks that analyze and look at these threats and prioritize them. So folks at the federal level are certainly aware of it, whether they're allowed to talk about it or not anymore remains to be seen. But, you know, they're certainly on the radar. Mm.
We have a tweet from Cynthia about Trump's infrastructure plan. She writes, not going to help any state. It privatizes for the benefit of corporate cronies. And once again, we taxpayers will foot the bill. Even more tolls, local taxes, you name it. So, Cynthia, thanks for your tweet. We welcome your tweet as well and your phone call, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. Let's talk about what's going on with wind power. Greg, the governor has declared a moratorium on new wind power permits except for Aroostook County. My first question is, does the governor have the power to do that?
I guess we're going to find out. There's a lawsuit that says he doesn't. I think more immediately what he has done is scared away investors who might be looking to get involved in a big renewable energy buy in Massachusetts. And some main projects were part of the thinking behind some of the bids. And if he creates uncertainty around the legality of their investment, they will probably look elsewhere with their money.
Yeah, it seems like the governor's decided that he can kind of play out the string on some of these things and at least not let them happen, things that he thinks are destructive in the last year. It's this wind, it's the main care expansion that he can he's only got 12 months or less than that now, and he can use his executive power to block them one way or the other.
Marijuana.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've got marijuana. We've got, you know, like you mentioned, the Medicaid expansion, which is both are referendum questions. Susan, it seems to me, though, that, you know, what we hear, what I hear in this seat, in the studio from listeners, is that they're frustrated that Augusta seems to be ignoring the will of the people. But what I hear from Augusta is they feel as though the referendum process is flawed. The governor yesterday said it was dangerous for the state of Maine. But I also think there are Democrats who don't like the way the referendum process is playing out. Where do we head with this? Are we going to have a different kind of referendum process in 2 or 3 years, or are the voters not going to stand for that?
Well, I think they're both right. I mean, I think clearly Augusta is ignoring or dragging their feet on the will of the voters. I mean, we see that with marijuana, as you mentioned. They just did away with the education surcharge that had been passed by voters. Now we're looking at, you know, whether we'll lower the minimum wage, which was also approved by voters. Is the referendum process imperfect? Absolutely. But some of the solutions that we have, I think, are pretty scary. No signature gathering at the polling place. You know, it's a pretty radical step. Look at how many referendums they have in California. I think once you open the door, it's really hard to pare that back. And the proposals that people have come up with in Maine, you know, just haven't really been workable so far.
Secretary of State Dunlap's proposal to eliminate or change the way petitions are being collected at polling places, that has died, right? That is no.
I think they're still considering
alive.
It's part of a bigger bill to change how elections are run. The problem they're going to run into here is the reason for the citizens initiative is to give the people an opportunity when the government's not responding to do something. And then because we've made it easier, outside groups can come in and Maine's become a good place to get some of these initiatives passed. Now what they're trying to figure out is how do we, you know, stop that latter group from coming in and spending money here to get their initiatives passed without hurting the citizens' ability to bring something forward. Right. And that's really difficult. I'm not sure there's anything all the things that they're talking about to make it more difficult to get something on the ballot will just make it more difficult for Maine citizens to get something on the ballot. And it will just mean people like Sean Scott will have to spend a little bit more money to get something on the ballot. And that's it. So,
and it's really hard to separate those two. Mm. I mean, a lot of these ideas have started with Maine grassroots groups, but then they start getting outside funding because it is costly to run a referendum campaign. So for opponents, it's easy to attack all of them as these are all outside interest groups, when in fact, a lot of the ideas did start organically here in Maine.
And the voters seem to be able to distinguish which ones are which. They voted down that casino, what was it, 8-1? The bear baiting referendum lost, the background checks for gun sales lost. Those were all seen as being imposed on the state from outside. And things like Medicaid expansion, it passed the legislature 5 times and it was vetoed and kept off the books by a minority in Augusta. And of course, that's going to turn into a referendum question.
We have two, a Facebook post and an email on the subject of race. An email from John: while I am against white supremacist views, we do need to recognize that the other ethnic groups say we are a group of, quote, white privileged individuals, and because of that, we may be racist. This view of us as white people in Maine needs to be countered, as this is reverse racism. I'm a hardworking individual who likes to treat people based on their character, not their color. And then Kale on Facebook writes, thank you for focusing on the issue of racism within the state of Maine. We do need to have these conversations because we are not, in spite of being one of the whitest states in the nation. So clearly we've hit a nerve. We had a topic last week about cross-racial conversations, which was a very very compelling program. Lots of calls, lots of emails, having discussions that we didn't have in this way a year ago.
You know, these discussions are really hard to have. It's a very awkward subject to talk about. You feel like you're about to say the wrong thing. And so it's good to get an email like that. I mean, to the person who was worried about being called a racist, I think a more helpful way for us to look at this is that racism is a thing that we do, not something that we are. And people are not racist or not racist. Racism is this system of oppression. And if you're doing something that contributes to oppressing somebody else, that's the activity we need to look at, not so much what your personal character is, because I think that's what it all comes down to. Even this guy in Jackman said, I'm not a racist, because he looked into his heart and he said, I don't feel, you know, animosity to anybody. But so I think the conversation, these are hard conversations to have, and they don't go anywhere as soon as you call somebody a racist. They shut down and stop listening. So I think it's important that we kind of think about, like, look at what we do and say, and not so much, try to impugn people's character.
Before we take a quick break, a word about tomorrow's program. We will discuss the outlook for Maine's real estate market in 2018. Email your comments and questions to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do WEX, providing global payment solutions for the fleet, travel, and health industries. Career opportunities at WEXINC.com. And Savvy Event Rental, sailcloth tents, handcrafted farm tables, and walnut cross back chairs for weddings and celebrations. SavvyEventRental.com.
Just like the weather this winter, the news has been pretty dynamic. Thankfully, there is Maine Public Radio to keep you up to date and make some sense of it, a trusted news source. Hi, this is Morning Edition host Erwin Gratz, urging you to do your part for listener-supported public radio, either right now or on our upcoming one-day Super Thursday fundraiser, February 8th. And if you've never supported public radio before, perhaps now is the time for you to recognize the value of the service and take that responsible step forward with whatever amount works for you. 800-866-1475 or mainepublic.org. And thanks for doing your part.
If you've ever wondered what the Maine Public app does, it allows you to take Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Classical with you on the go for mobile streaming anywhere and anytime. You can catch up on the news or your favorite programs. You also have access to many PBS and Maine Public television programs. The Maine Public app is available for Apple and Android smartphones and tablets, and you can download it for free from both the Apple App Store and the Google Play Store.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, what stories made Maine headlines in January? Which matter? Joining me today, Ben Bragdon, editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. Greg Kessage, the editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. And joining us from our Bangor studio, Susan Young, editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. I believe this is pronounced Magili or Magali on Facebook says, can anyone address where things stand on opening the Maine Atlantic coast to drilling for oil? I believe there's an open forum held in Augusta January 22nd to hear from the public on this issue. Backward thinking in terms of the health of Maine's economy, renewable energy, and the health of the planet. So we know that the president has announced that he will do something in the future. There will be a plan to open more water for drilling. We know that Florida now has been exempted, that every governor in the East Coast except for Governor LePage opposes drilling. Our entire congressional delegation opposes drilling. What do we know about whether or not people want to drill off the coast of Maine? Do oil companies see us as a valuable place to explore?
I haven't heard any evidence that there's anything for them to drill for.
Yeah, there's a couple areas where they. Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple areas
that's
where they think there may be some. Go ahead, Susan. Maybe you were.
No, I was going to say that's my understanding as well. And some of the largest oil companies are pulling back from offshore drilling, you know, not obviously off the coast of Maine, but even in places where we know there are proven reserves, because the cost of offshore drilling is really, really expensive. I think a drilling rig starts at $650 million. And as they're reducing the cost of drilling onshore, especially in the Dakotas and elsewhere, it's just much easier to get as much oil as you can off the land before you make the huge investments to consider doing it offshore. So, I mean, that's my understanding. I think Chevron and a couple other companies are actually paring back on offshore drilling just because of the cost.
We're in the middle of an oil boom. Like Susan was saying, from the center of within the United States, it's really kind of transforming the whole energy industry. Just 8-10 years ago, people were talking about peak oil and running out, and now that's doesn't seem to be the problem. It's price variation. Yeah, go ahead.
Domestically, demand is going down.
Yeah.
You know, people are getting more fuel efficient vehicles, electric vehicles. So, as you say, Greg, we're producing more than ever, but domestically
we're
not
exporting.
Using as much as we did. Yeah.
And I heard the governor yesterday saying that, this would help Mainers who heat their houses with oil. And I'm wondering, where is this crude going to be refined? You know, this is the next step. Well, first we'll have the rigs and then we'll have the big refinery on the Maine coast. That'll go over well.
Yeah, the governor's always been very concerned with energy prices today and what he can do to make them lower tomorrow, but he never really looks out further than that. I mean, I heard him say yesterday about this UMaine wind project that was so expensive. It's so expensive because it's just a test, and they're going to put one out there. It's not going to, 15 years from now, maybe Maine's a place where this is a big deal. So it's kind of short-sighted thinking.
Our phone number. I think that public forum on the 22nd was postponed because of weather, but I haven't heard of a new date for it.
All right. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. An email from Jill talking about how someone might register for the primary for a day. She writes, if you change your party enrollment, you may not leave that party for 90 days. So you have to be a Republican or Democrat for 90 days if you vote in a primary. So interesting point to make. And it'll be interesting to see how many people do that. How many people, especially, I think, as you said, Greg, who are not registered with a party now, who might register with a party to vote for a Republican candidate they like or a Democratic candidate?
If you look at how independents vote, they tend to split between Democrats and Republicans, usually voting for one or the other very consistently, just as consistently as registered party members. So will they feel, do they want to have some influence in terms of who their candidate is going to be? I think that's the question.
Okay, Susan, I know that you did not want to end this hour without talking about Senator Collins' talking stick. So why don't you, instead of me trying to recap the story of what happened, why don't you do that for us?
Susan has the talking stick now.
Okay, and I'll let you know when I'm going to throw it at you so you can catch it, because we don't want to break anything. I mean, I give Senator Collins credit for pulling together this group of moderate senators, before the shutdown started and then through the brief shutdown. But apparently they used a talking stick, which, as my daughter pointed out, hey, we did that in kindergarten. Uh-huh. And you can only talk when you have the stick in your hand, right? And I said, yes. So they have the talking stick so they can all be civil to each other. But apparently things got a little out of hand. Lamar Alexander apparently threw the talking stick to Senator Mark Warner, who didn't catch it. And a glass elephant was broken in the process. So a lot of symbolism there that it was a glass elephant. But I mean, these are U.S. senators. To me, it's just pathetic that they need to use a talking stick in order to come together and talk to one another and hammer out a compromise. I think we should expect much more from our elected leaders. They shouldn't need gimmicks, especially kindergarten gimmicks, to work together and work things out. This is what we expect them to do. This is what we need them to do. So,
yeah,
funny story, but sad at the same time.
I thought it was incredible that it was treated as such a remarkable event that 20-something senators got together in a meeting and talked about finding middle ground. Like, wow, did anybody ever think of that before? You know, this is kind of...
it was front page news.
It's become so unusual. You know, it's kind of a sort of a testament to our times. It's become that kind of exercise has become very unusual.
Okay, Narcan. We have made it almost to the end of the hour. The Pharmacy Board is meeting tomorrow. Do we know? My understanding is that the Pharmacy Board has been waiting for Governor LePage to sign something so that pharmacists can sell Narcan over the counter. And this is something you give someone who is overdosing on an opioid to revive them. The governor has not signed it. The governor, my understanding is that he doesn't think he needs to sign it. What happens next?
I guess I'd be very surprised if the board didn't sign off on these on Thursday, but anything's possible. I mean, they're obviously frightened of what the governor might do if they pass these laws. If they publish these rules, they've been passed. This is the law. It's into law. Neither of these groups should be able to hold it up. And the governor, frankly, I think is just playing dumb on this. He knows exactly what he's doing. He's been doing it the entire time, keeping Narcan out of the hands of people with one absurd argument after another. And the newest one was, if you can't have cigarettes, you can't have Narcan. And I don't know. I mean, I'd say I'm speechless, but I've written about 5,000 words on this over the last week, so I guess I'm not. But it just it flies in the face of all evidence and all experience. And Narcan isn't cigarettes. It's not even acetaminophen. It's you can't overdose on it. It doesn't harm anybody. It's just there to take a person out of a overdose. And why we don't have this everywhere right now is, this should have happened 2-3 years ago. And that it hasn't is a real stain on the governor.
Yeah.
Let's remember that the board unanimously approved these rules in August. So the board backs these rules. And it seems to me if the governor's going to refuse to act, they're really going to need to step up and fill that leadership void and enact, implement these rules that they have already agreed are appropriate.
You know, there's a number of people who have died since August 5th. We don't know exactly how many because those statistics kind of lag, but 185 people died in the first half of 2017, and that's more than one a day. I think 179 days have passed since August 5th. If it was one person a day dying, some of that number would have been saved by Narcan. We don't know what that number is. It's not zero. It's a very valuable medicine in the exact right circumstances. And to shuffle his feet and claim that he doesn't know what people are talking about and saying that the numbers aren't on his desk or pretending that he's got some, I think he said very clearly yesterday on your show, this doesn't save lives, it extends lives, which has been his position since the very beginning, and no amount of information can shake him from that.
And he also said yesterday that, if you get a shot in Narcan, you go into treatment and you get yourself help, he has no problem with it. Well, it's tough to get treatment in this state, and he's made it harder. And so that's one thing. And how do you know who you're keeping the Narcan from? How do you know if you're keeping it from the person who's had one or the person who has 20? It shouldn't matter. It shouldn't matter. But, you get stuck in these circular thing in the governor's head. And we just, I don't know. I don't know what else is left to do on this issue.
So I'm going to go quickly to Lori, because I think this is what you want to talk about. Right, Lori, in Wiscasset, that talk about Narcan?
Yes, I was calling to just express what I am frustrated with, that it's pretty obvious to people that the governor just wants people to die. And with Narcan, just die already really should be his policy. He should just state it. We want them to die. That's how they act. That's his policy. And someone just needs to say it out loud. And it's the policy that the Republican Party wants to do with people and health care. Just die.
Well,
almost like they think there's too many people out there.
He did say in the last State of the Union, Laurie, we won't get out of the opioid problem until this generation dies. And I've heard him say that in other realms, yeah. too.
Laurie, thanks for your call. Trying to squeeze in one more before the end of the hour, going to Peg and Vianna. Hi, Peg. If you could be quick, that'd be great.
Hi, Jen. I am concerned. I have just read that there's an act in the legislature to impose an annual fee on hybrid and electric vehicles. I didn't spend the extra money to get a hybrid to pay more money to the state. And apparently this is coming from the oil industry groups.
All right, Peg, any of our columnists or any of your...
We talked to the chairman of the Transportation Department last year. The legislator, and I forget his name, is from Westbrook. The problem they're trying to get at is that we're not raising enough money in the gas tax to cover maintenance on the roads. And at that time, at least, they were talking about increasing the gas tax and having some kind of fee on hybrid vehicles or on electric vehicles that don't use gas. It's a small problem now in terms of people free riding, but it could be a huge problem in a few years if the trucking industry moves to electric trucks, which seems like where they're headed.
All right, Peg, and thank you for your call. You will be the last call this hour. I look forward to having all of you back here next month. I hope it'll be a little shorter since February is a shorter month. Our guest, Susan Young, editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News. She joined us from our Bangor studio here in Portland. Greg Kessage, editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. And Ben Bragdon, the editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today. We had help from Rich Tozier. You can find past editions of Maine Calling at mainecalling.org. And today's program will be broadcast tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Thursday on the program, the outlook for real estate in Maine in 2018. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.